As I told last week, the first one was on solitude. And last week I talked about listening. And today I'm going to talk about speaking. And with the idea that these three make a kind of a package, and that it's a package which is one aspect, or a very important aspect, I feel, of a Buddhist spiritual life, or maybe any spiritual life. And in particular, I think of these three aspects as being very important for the integration of the practice, our meditation practice, into our daily life, and applying it and finding applications for it in our daily life. And this thing about solitude is very much related to what I call sometimes naked awareness. Which is kind of enough in itself. It doesn't need anything. And what I call, in calling solitude, maybe other people would call being centered, or being at home with oneself. Or I'm sure there's many synonyms for the similar state. But a state of being in some ways with a state of awareness, state of presence, that doesn't need to be propped up or defended by anything at all. Naked awareness. And this kind of awareness, I feel, or can be felt as being very much related or connected to such notions as silence or spaciousness in space. And an awareness itself, and what we do here is an awareness practice, has many of the same qualities as space, has many of the same qualities as silence, in that both space and silence and awareness are non-judgmental, they're non-critical. In some ways, you can even say, I think, to say they're forgiving, incredibly forgiving. And to discover this kind of awareness, is it not critical or evaluative or judgmental, it can be very freeing to discover this possibility. And in solitude, or in the relief of solitude, and when I wrote this word relief of solitude in my notes, I realized there's double meanings of the word. That what I had in mind was the relief of solitude is the highlight of solitude. Kind of like a relief on a wall, but also I was delighted to see it also means like the relief, the vacation of solitude. The relief of solitude and silence, I think, helps very much deepen intimacy, and also the art of listening. Without some deep sense of solitude or deep sense of being at home with oneself, I don't think it's possible to listen deeply to oneself or to the world around one or to one's friends. And in deep silence, in deep listening, we can hear the quiet, our own quiet voice, the quiet sense we have within us of our own deep integrity, our personal, both our personal and I think also kind of universal truth that sometimes is so quiet that it's covered over by the busy lives that we live and the busy minds that we have. So there's solitude and there's listening. And the ability to perfect or to try to perfect the art of listening requires, I think, an open sense of time. That if you have a closed or narrow sense of what time is and the amount of time you have, I think it's difficult to really listen and really be comfortable with your solitude. You have to have an open-ended sense of time in order to, I think, in order to have a spiritual life at all, I believe. So what do we listen to is one of the great questions. What is it to listen to? So I came across this story. When a man whose marriage was in trouble sought advice, the master said, "You must learn to listen to your wife." The man took this advice to heart and returned after a month to say he had learned to listen to every word his wife was saying. Said the master with a smile, "Now go home and listen to every word she isn't saying." And then there's this, this is a somewhat famous quote from Mahayana Buddhist scripture called the Lankavatara Sutra. And it's the source for the image in Zen Buddhism. In Zen they say, don't confuse the finger for the moon. The moon is a symbol for enlightenment. And so all anybody can ever do is talk about it or point the finger in the direction of it, but then some people confuse the finger for the moon. So this sutra says, the Buddha says in the sutra, May every practitioner take care not to cling to words, as if words were a perfect expression of the meaning, because truth is not in the letters. When a person points to something with a finger, the tip of the finger may be mistaken for the thing pointed at. In the same way, the ignorant are like children, incapable of giving up the idea that in the fingertip of words the actual meaning is contained. So there's some idea you find in many areas, many religious traditions, that words aren't complete in themselves, or words are inadequate. And Buddhism has kind of nuances of teachings around this. Buddhism tends to respect words a lot and have a very important place for words, but also recognition that there's much more being communicated often than just the literal meaning of the words. So in the story of the man who had to listen to what his wife wasn't saying, I think it's very important sometimes to listen to the things that are not being said but are still being communicated. And I've heard said that one generality, stereotypic difference between men and women, and I don't know if it's true, but I noticed it at a few meetings I've gone to, this seemed to hold true there at the meetings, is that some people, or at least some women, tend to not listen to the literal words of what's being said so much as they listen to the way it's being said, the sense of what's being said, and that men tend to listen more to what's actually being said, the words and the meanings. So if you're listening to those two differently, those two different areas, regardless of how, you know, why, you pick up different messages depending on what you're listening to. And I think in some ways words as fingers pointing, that words are can also be taken as hints, that many of the words we get are hints to something wider and bigger that's being communicated. So the literal meaning versus how it's said. And I think that often how it's said expresses much better the intention of the speaker than what is being said. And if you listen very carefully, the intention sometimes can be completely opposite of what is being said. And someone can be saying very kind words, but they're meant maybe even hostily, or there's a lot of anger, or and you can pick up the anger if you listen to the tone or the quality or the embodied expression that's being said. And it's more and more, I think it's probably been said many times, but more and more in our society, in our modern society, there's becoming many new ways of communicating that didn't exist before. In the old days, most communication happened face-to-face. And probably a lot of teaching spiritual teachers give now didn't have to be given 2,000 years ago because of the kind of communication that people had. But more and more there's what I call disembodied communication. We had letters for a while, and they're pretty good, especially when they're handwritten, and there's something else sometimes being communicated in the handwriting. But now I don't write handwriting letters hardly ever anymore because I want to use my spell check. And so then we have telephones, and then we have faxes, and then we have modems and email. And what it does is it increasingly takes, you know, faxes and modems then. I mean, you don't have to even the channel of the human voice is not being used anymore. And it becomes completely disembodied. At Stanford last year when the Dalai Lama was here, someone asked the Dalai Lama, explained to him about how communication in emails is disembodied communication. And if there were, if Buddhism had anything to say about the ethics of disembodied communication. And the Dalai Lama said, oh yeah, there are such beings, disembodied beings up there. And it's very important to be honest, he said. It's very important. If you're disembodied, it's particularly important to be honest. So much of what was used to be communicated interpersonally is lost in this technological means of communicating. And it's interesting to reflect what is lost in the process. Some people would say a lot is gained, but I think it's important to recognize what is lost also. And I think that in some ways a person's the sense of someone's integrity, an old-fashioned word, probably is, used to be communicated by the, another old-fashioned word was by a person's bearing. How a person carried oneself when they spoke or did something, you could trust them by how they, you know, who they were. If you just receive an email message, who are you? What do you have? Who are you talking to? There was a story of a woman's bulletin, an email, a woman's kind of discussion group, and there was a woman who participated for a good length of time, like nine months, and was very much respected and appreciated by other the women on the email because of her contributions and things she had to say, until it was discovered that she was a he. And they had no way of knowing for most of that time, because on email you can make up your whatever identity you want. Mm-hmm. And some people value the anonymity of email, of technological means of communicating. But I'm a little bit suspicious of that. Why people value anonymity. I think that being anonymous has its value. You can express things maybe otherwise you feel a little bit hesitant to express. But I feel it's unfortunate we live in a culture where people aren't respected enough that they feel that they can express themselves as they need to without having to become anonymous. So listening. So we listen to something very different when we get a letter or we get an email message or we get a fax. There's a Japanese poet who wrote, "I don't take your words merely as words, far from it. I listen to what makes you talk, whatever that is, and me listen." What makes us talk? What's the intention behind it? There's a famous German philosopher who I was sentenced to read. And I just couldn't make any sense of it at all. It was a graduate seminar, and I thought, you know, I might not be that smart, but someone who makes it to graduate school, if they can't, I couldn't make any sense of it. But anyways, later I was happy to find a quote from him that made a lot of sense. His name is Gadamer. "Unlike seeing, where one can look away, one cannot hear away, but must listen. Hearing implies already belonging together in such a manner that one is claimed by what is being said." So I like hearing. When you listen, you can't turn away from the sounds as easily. You can turn away your eyes. And so I like very much, for this reason and other reasons, the language of hearing and listening much more than the language of seeing for spiritual practice and for mindfulness practice. And there's a lot of language of seeing. A sage is a seer, for example. And insight kind of implies also that word seeing. But to hear, I think, because you can't turn away. So what is behind the words that we listen to? What is it we communicate? What do we communicate behind or through or together with the literal meanings of the words? And I think often what you'll pick up is sometimes fear, or desire, or greed, or ambition, power, anger, or love and joy, appreciation, delight, caring, and compassion. All these things can be picked up in the subtleties of the way someone says something to you. The way someone says, that was a nice job. There can be a whole range of what they actually mean. And what's behind people's ideology, when people spout ideology? What's behind that? And I think often ideology is a cover for something very personal. I asked today at Stanford among the... I asked here some weeks ago how many of you knew about I statements. And as I remember, only about 6, 7, 8 people raised their hands. How many people today know about I statements? Except you heard about it, I talked about it a few weeks ago. Well, there's many more, so maybe, I don't know. But it seemed like maybe it was almost like maybe close to half now. And I asked the students at Stanford today how many, and I think 90% of them knew about it. And maybe it's someone. I asked one of them where she learned it, and she said in high school. And I think making I statements is one of the most powerful means of communicating to oneself and uncovering oneself and to others that we have. And I think it's a skill that's really well worth learning. Because so much we interpret and abstract so easily, and the abstractions and the interpretations and ideology cover something which is really precious, which is our own personal relationship to what's going on. So someone can have an ideology, political ideology, and if you listen carefully to that person, or if you probe, or that person starts making personal I statements about what's going on, rather than saying, oh, you know, we need to have democracy, or we need to have this or that, what you might hear is there might be some fear under there. There's a fear of what would happen if the disenfranchised or themselves didn't have a voice. And it's a very different from someone to say, I'm afraid what it'd be like not to have a voice. There's a very different kind of intimacy to that, as opposed to someone saying, we have to have democracy, or whatever the equivalent is. And I think often, if our conversations are very abstract, and sometimes idealistic or ideological, people can miss each other very much, or can clash. Whereas if they're talking about how it is for them personally, then I don't think you'll ever have a clash. You'll have a meeting between two people. And it's said in Buddhism, and it's said, I think, maybe other places, that real, so-called real or true, in a spiritual sense, seeing or listening, is experienced with all one's senses. It isn't something you don't just really hear with your ears or see with your eyes, but it's something that you do with your whole body, with all your senses. It kind of arises out of a sense of presence or silence or solitude or centeredness, where one picks up everything. And I think one of the things we learn, if you listen after meditating, or if you're meditating, you listen to the rain or listen to something, you'll hear in a very different way, I think, than you would normally. Probably differently than you listen to television or the news. Or in Zen monasteries or Zen centers, when people give Dharma talks, everybody continues to meditate. And it's very difficult to give a Dharma talk in a Zen center because everybody's... you tell a joke and everybody's... Or they're looking at, well, they're facing you, but they're looking, well, yeah, usually they're facing you, but they're looking down at the floor. And, you know, Zen masters like to talk for, traditionally, you know, Dharma talks go on and on. And, you know, I've sat in the Dharma talks that were 2 hours long, and there's an ethic in Zen where you're supposed to keep meditating, not move. So after a while, you're not listening anymore, you're just coping with your legs. But true seeing and true hearing comes out of being present with all our senses. And I was thinking about all this, and when I was writing my these notes, and then I thinking that maybe religion is religion often is a conservative force, often in a very negative way. But one way I think religion is conservative in a healthy way is with this the increasing technologization of our society, the increasing depersonalization that happens in our society. Religion, hopefully, or at least Buddhist spirituality and meditation, is encouraging us to don't forget the kind of personal contact which is so rich and so important, which I think it's our society is doing its darnest to prevent. Just simply having an ATM machine. I remember going to a bank back in my hometown in Norway after being gone for many, many years. And it's a big city of some 200,000-300,000 people. But going into a bank and the bank teller knowing, recognizing me as the grandson of so-and-so. They knew my grandparents. Or I worked as a longshoreman on the docks for a while. And the foreman son had gone out with my mother. You know, it's personal contact. It's really, really rich. So maybe religion is conservative, pulling us back into the body when we get disembodied. And disembodiment also is not only is technological, interpersonal, but it's also with ourselves and personal alienation. And if we get alienated from our words, if our words become disembodied, then it's very hard to do, as beautiful expression said, to stand by one's words, to stand by one's word. I think to stand by one's word, one has to be embodied. The Chinese word for faith or trust or confidence, the Chinese characters are made up of stories, right? And the character for faith is a character for man on the left, or person on the left, and on the right is a character for words. So the person who stands together with their word, when a person stands together with their word, that's faith in some kind of way. So to listen carefully, to be quiet for a while, to be solitary for a while, is to give our words a chance to find us. Often our words are not... give our thoughts a chance to find us. I talked about doing these council at Spirit Rock, learning to do a council system of meeting. And another kind of workshop kind of ways people have of talking and listening. And what struck me was that if someone's given 2 or 3 or 4 minutes to talk uninterruptedly, one of the rules for council was you're not supposed to plan what you're going to say. So you have to just wait and say it as when it's your turn to speak, you start speaking. But if you have 2 or 3 or 5 minutes to talk without having planned it so much, that you might be surprised at what you say. And one of the values of not interrupting someone is you might find them that really what they want to say is something very different than what you want to interrupt them to find out about. Just wait and give them a chance. Give yourself a chance. The power of words. Religions down through history have recognized that words have tremendous power. And part of the power you can see in the consequences of words. And in a secular society, I think much of the strength and the variety of the uses of words is lost. And just to give kind of a sense of what sacred words have been in religious traditions, including Buddhist ones, you have such words as vows. Vows have been extremely sacred and important, the language and the words of vows. Mantras in Buddhism and Indian religions. Spells, chants, protective formulas, praise, prayer. Those are the words, those are the kind of lists I can come up with. Can you think of any other sacred uses of words?
Story,
yeah. Very important. I had a conversation yesterday with someone about what do you tell your child, if you're atheist or basically agnostic, what do you tell your children when they come home and ask about God? And so we were talking about Genesis and stories, and then today I was out for a run. And I thought the way that the Bible should start is, in the beginning there was a story. The story can be the translation for logos. And in secular society, we still have a few charged words, and one of them is oaths of office, and oaths in trials. But also vows of marriage are one of the most charged words still left. And even we tried to secularize that. And there's this beautiful essay by Wendell Berry called Poetry and Marriage, The Use of Old Forms. And I'll read a little bit for you. The meaning of marriage begins in the giving of words. We cannot join ourselves to another without giving our word. In marriage, as in poetry, the given word implies the acceptance of a form that is never entirely of one's own making. When understood seriously enough, a form is a way of accepting and living within the limits of creaturely life. These forms are artificial. If they exist, they have to be made. Sexual love is natural, but marriage is not. The impulse to sing is natural, but language and the form of song are not. These forms are also initially arbitrary, because at the outset they can be made, they can always be argued against. Until the wedding vows are said, the argument that one might find a better spouse has standing, because there's no argument or evidence that can be produced against it. Statistical probability would seem to support it, given the number of theoretical possible choices. One might make a better choice. Similarly, before the poem, there is no necessity governing the choice of form. The forms then are arbitrary before they are entered upon. Afterward, they have the same undoubtable existence and standing as the forms of an elm or a river. A poet such as Spenser evidently entered upon the form of a poem as solemnly as he entered upon any other cultural form, that of public service, say, or that of marriage. He understood it both as enablement and as constraint, and he meant not to break it, for in keeping the form he did not merely obey an arbitrary imposed technical requirement, but maintained his place in his cultural lineage as both inheritor and bequeather, which saved him from loneliness and enabled him to mean. And he goes on and on, very nice. But to give one's word, what does it mean to give one's word? And we give our word in marriage. And then what happens? When I like that. Singing is natural, the impulse to sing. But the song, once you enter into the song has rules and limits, and if your song is going to work. The way we use, where, how do we use our words? When I worked at Green's restaurant many years ago as a kind of fast order cook, it was very busy, and all these waiters and dish kind of bus people are coming in and out, and I have little bit of contact with a lot of people over a period of time because I'm serving up the food and they're taking it away or receiving an order or whatever. So sometimes I made it a practice that every time someone came rushing by, I would say something, have some kind of verbal exchange that I hope would make things better for them, make them feel better. It was like this kaleidoscope of people coming in front, and I had to kind of remember what I'd said when they had visited 5 minutes before. And I remember one person, I was talking about Shakespeare, and some of that was what kind of was getting the kind of changing your mood, was talking about Shakespeare. So I had to remember, you know, where we left off, and the next person came, and it was kind of like a game of, can I use my words, the way I spoke, to make this very tense situation go smoother? Or like a friend of mine, it was a great place to work because there's all these Zen students there. There's a Zen student there who's doing dishwasher. And his task was, he wanted to see if he could wash the dishes and receive the dishes in such a way, because dishes, people bring dirty dishes in, that's like the, you know, no one pays any attention to what they're doing, except they don't want to break them, but they want to get out of there as quickly as they can from the dishwashing place and just dump them and run away. And he tried to make the dishwashing area and his encounter with people who brought the dishes transformative for the people who came with the dishes, and somehow make it them kind of make them feel lighter and better about themselves or about their work. And he said that he could feel a difference as the evening went on. After a while, people would come, and rather than just dump the dishes there, they would just kind of put them there. So words have consequences. Speaking has consequences. Many other consequences besides giving information. And I think I've run out of time, more or less. I was going to talk about, really get into what Buddhism has to say about speech. And maybe I'll save that for another time, since Buddhism says a lot about speech. One of the interesting, important reasons to talk about speaking and speech is that many people, after they meditated for a while, are impelled or inspired to try to bring a sense of integrity or wholeness or peace that comes in meditation into the rest of their normal life, to somehow integrate the meditation into their normal life in some kind of way, so there's not such a big dissonance between their daily life and meditation. It's like this story I tell sometimes of this guy who came on retreat, lawyer, who came on retreat, and he came to an interview and he said, in my job I'm expected to lie. And how can I, as a Buddhist practitioner, continue lying? And he meant it. He wanted to know how the tools were, what the tools were like. And you can't if you can start integrating the two. I think one of the most difficult places to integrate, one of the most difficult areas to try to practice in daily life, is around speech. And I don't feel like I'm just barely, not even a beginner, I feel. It's such a huge subject. But if you're serious about practicing, you have to look at it there also. The other precepts, it's kind of, you can argue different depending how you look at it, but in a gross way, we're not going to break the other precepts very often. But all of us, I'm sure, break the precept of not to lie. My guess is many times a day. We lie when we exaggerate. We lie when there's lies of omission, and many things. And it's really, speech and the way we speak is, if you listen carefully, is this door that if you step through this door, it opens up to this vast world of our deeper life, of our subconscious, of our interpersonal life, of intimacy. So to learn how to speak, I like what I said last week, that God gave us two ears and one mouth so that we can listen twice as much as we hear, twice as much as we speak. So with that, maybe I should stop speaking. So we have three or four minutes, so let's end with a little sitting. We'll sit for 2 minutes. So thank you very much for the nice gift this evening, a book. And thank you even more for coming here week after week. And I feel tremendously inspired in my own practice in life by the great commitment or great consistency that many of you have shown in practicing exploring this world of mindfulness and yourself, and to have so many of you come back week after week, I think is phenomenal. And to have so many people who are negotiating the way in such a way. So I want to thank you for bringing that here. So I wish you all well, and good night.